take a minute to check your social battery. How's it doing? It's easy to ignore our needs and spread ourselves too thin. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/popcastpod today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/popcastpod.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your thrift store organ of music news and criticism. I'm your host, Ben Ratliff. And you're listening to Cherie by Suicide. The occasion for that song on this program is that Alan Vega of Suicide died last Saturday. And to talk about Alan Vega, we have with us Geeta Dayal. Hey, Geeta.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Geeta Dayal is a music journalist I've been reading for a long time, who writes about music and also technology and the ways they overlap in the history of electronic music. She's written a book about the album Another Green World by Brian Eno, part of the 33 and a Third book series. But in general, when you come across a piece written by Geeta Dayal about electronic music, you're coming across something that has been very well historically researched. So I go to her to find out about timelines, context, how a musician or how a band sits in history, not just in its own scene, country, culture, but even in a larger sense. With that in mind, I want to talk about Alan Vega and Suicide, because I feel like they're a real connector piece band in music history, you know, 20th century music history. But it's really hard to say exactly where they fit in. They're proto a lot of things, but they also were influenced by a lot of things. They connect a lot of really far apart things. I mean, what was your introduction to Suicide?
Well, first of all, thanks for the amazing introduction. That was very, very kind of you. My personal introduction was, I think it was a teenager, and when I heard that first album, I was really struck by how minimalist it was, how incredibly minimal the sound was, and also how powerful it was. It was powerful, minimal music. It foreshadowed a lot of the music I was starting to get into. And it connected a lot of strands of music I was already interested in.
Such as?
Such as 80s industrial music, post-punk music, which you'd say Suicide was a post-punk band. And also
to tech. Or a pre-punk band.
Yeah, even a pre-punk band, too. You could also say they invented the word punk music on a flyer in 1971. Well, Lester Bangs used it in a piece, the word punk, I think in 69, and then they appropriated it for a flyer.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they were the first to really use the word punk music, you know, on a flyer as a description for their sound.
Right. It may not have been a term of art the way they were using it, like a musical adjective, but the way it was presented there, framed on that flyer, it looked as if it were.
Yeah.
And that was sort of the beginning of it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Early 80s electro records. I see definitely connections between a lot of the music I liked. Techno, a lot of other music really connects to Suicide in ways that Suicide probably could have never predicted. It's really a subtle connection. It's not like a very obvious connection like Kraftwerk, where you can really see a clear line between Kraftwerk and a lot of electronic music that came after their classic work in the 70s. With Suicide, everything was much more subtle and much more subliminal. I think you can hear a lot of producers even today kind of taking Suicide's classic sound into account. I think also Alan Vega had even said in interviews that he didn't consider Suicide to be a punk band, which is really like the most punk thing you could say is, you know, saying, well, you know, my band isn't completely just putting that all by the wayside, saying, well, I'm not part of that. That's not me.
Yeah.
Well, which kind of makes him more punk, like I would say.
Right, right. But who's to say he's wrong? I mean, it's kind of true. It wasn't a punk band. So Suicide, just to catch up, anybody who may not know, started maybe in a conceptual sense or like very, very basic beginnings, early 70s. But it took them until 1977 to release anything. Is that correct?
Yes. Their first album came out in 1977. It's a very interesting album because it is, like I said, it's so stripped down. They didn't use guitars. They didn't even use synthesizers. That album was made with an organ and this rhythm box that only had like these pretty cheesy presets on it. Like there was a samba button or a cha-cha button. And they made this whole album with that organ, this rhythm box that Martin Rev found at a furniture store.
Do you know exactly what kind of organ, what kind of rhythm box?
It was a Farfisa organ, the rhythm box. It's this pretty cheesy looking rhythm box called the, made by this company called Seberg. And it has fake wood paneling on the outside. It was made beginning in the 1960s, I believe. You have to remember that drum machines, as we know them, even the classic drum machines, they didn't really exist. So in 1977, a lot of the drum machines that we associate with kind of the classic music that a lot of us love in electronic music, like let's say the 808 or whatever, those didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
Those drum machines weren't around. You used these really cheesy rhythm boxes.
Right.
But it was certainly never designed to be used in the way that Suicide used
commercially
it.
Commercially or as part of a self-conscious art project or anything like that. What I have always known about Alan Vega and Martin Rev, the other half of Suicide, is that Alan Vega was already in his early 40s, right, by the time of the early records. He came from Brooklyn, and he loved Elvis Presley. What I've always heard about Martin Rev is that he had a background in jazz. So how do you triangulate all that with the music that finally came out of them? When you hear that, where's the jazz training? Where's the Elvis Presley?
Alan Vega was a visual artist. You know, he had all this training, background kind of making art. He played trumpet. You know, a lot of people were extremely inspired by, let's say, by all of this jazz music. I mean, I can't imagine living in the 1960s and not being inspired by that music.
Sure.
He was also messing around with electronics. He had a two-track tape recorder. He was doing some pretty basic but interesting experiments, little electronic experiments. And he was, the early iterations of Suicide in the early 70s was Marty Rev on drums and Alan Vega playing trumpet. They abandoned that setup. There was a whole series of configurations. And at one point in the extremely early days, Suicide had three people. And then this third guy, who I believe was supposed to play guitar, left. He had some other plans. Mm-hmm. I think he went on to make films or something. And so then there were just the two of them. That's the other really powerful thing about Suicide is it's just two guys making all of this noise.
Yeah.
You know, so they're subverting the kind of hierarchy of the singer, the guitar and the bass player, and then the drummer in the back, you know, this classic rock band setup. They were incredibly aggressive and confrontational on stage. Like various people who saw them in the early days would say, you know, if I saw Suicide in the 70s, I would always stand near the door in case I had to leave.
Sure.
The aggressive confrontational aspect to Suicide, I think Alan Vega really took a lot of inspiration from seeing Iggy Pop perform in 1969 at Flushing Meadows Park. That completely melted his brain. I think he was just so moved by how in-your-face Iggy Pop was, the incredible, I'm looking for words that are not raw power, but, you know, the incredible immediacy of the Stooges' sound. He decided to move away from making visual art into this immediacy of being a front man and being on stage. And Alan Vega also really prided himself on being able to take the street from the street to the stage.
Yeah.
You know, he wanted things on the stage to be as freaky as the streets were in New York City in the 1970s. He wanted them to be, he didn't want to transport his listeners away from the dark ugliness of reality. It reminds me a lot of Lou Reed in a lot of ways and the Velvet Underground.
Yes, the Iggy Pop thing, I can understand how, I know some other people who went to that same concert in Queens, and I can understand what that must have been to encounter that for the first time and to see how creative it can be when a performer engages with a crowd like that. You know, and the whole thing becomes an experiment in aggression, maybe, but also in trust. Alan Vega, at a certain point, I think, had to trust that the audience wouldn't kill him, you know, and the audience had to trust that he wouldn't kill them. So there's that part of him as an artist. There's also the way he used words and thought about words and framed them in a song. What do you think about that when you hear his kind of rambling style that would change every time he did a song? You know, the contents of the song would change. The stories he would tell in songs were sort of like elusive, or they would sort of trail off into nothingness, or there'd just be an image. Again, I'm grasping for, like, how do they fit in? What traditions were they from? Traditions that happened at the same time as them, did they have something to do with? And what did they give rise to?
Yeah. You know, with somebody like Lou Reed, you can draw much more of a direct line, like, let's say, poetry, and with literature and with all of these things. With Alan Vega, it's a little more opaque. There's a really funny story about Allen Ginsberg and Alan Vega meeting. And Alan Vega was a big fan of Howl. He was excited to meet Allen Ginsberg, but then Allen Ginsberg sat Vega down and he said, you know, I'm really concerned about this name, Suicide, you know, for your band. And he was being, you know, a real kind of hippie about it. I think with Vega, you know, I would say as somebody who has been listening to electronic music and dance music for as long as I have, I pay less attention to lyrics, I would say, the absolute meaning of lyrics. And I treat them more as another sonic element. So, like, Alan Vega's vocals to me are this other layer, sonic layer, on top of Suicide's sound.
Yep.
Where the lyrics can be elusive and they can put strange images into your head from time to time, but the actual meanings of, like, strings of words together.
Yeah.
Is not something that I would particularly analyze as having, like, a particular symbolic meaning. I think Suicide would sound incredibly different, let's say, with a very different kind of singer.
Sure.
Like, if you could imagine Suicide with somebody who really was a trained singer who wasn't, like, mumbling their lyrics or screaming them or doing all the antics that Alan Vega was pulling, if somebody was really singing it the way you would sing it in a music conservatory, Suicide wouldn't be Suicide,
sure.
You know?
Yeah.
And so a lot of it's about the elocution and, like, the way and the diction. It's like about Alan Vega's style and the way that he throws these lyrics out.
More than considering the lines as, like, poetry or something like that.
Yeah, to me they are a strange kind of poetry,
yeah.
But they're also, you know, it falls in line with a lot of the other music that was happening in the 70s.
Sure, yes. I was going to say, so here I'm thinking The Fall.
The Fall.
I'm thinking Throbbing Gristle.
But even David Bowie, I mean, look at David Bowie and the way he would use cut-up lyrics and put them together in strange configurations. Even, like, let's say a song like Moon Age Daydream by David Bowie, these lines are lines that were created really in a very dreamlike, cut-up manner. They weren't meant to have any particular sense in order, necessarily.
Sure.
I'm an alligator. You can make your own meanings based on what you hear. Same with Brian Eno, who really used whatever lyrics. He either scrambled them up into nonsense or he used his own series of techniques to come up with lyrics.
Sure.
But again, they weren't. There were plenty of people in the 1970s who had lyrics that really didn't make any straightforward kind of sense.
Sure, that's right. All right, so let's pause here for a second because I want to play just a little bit of Dream Baby Dream, the song that came out between the first and second Suicide albums.
That's one of, I would say, one of the most beloved Suicide songs is Dream Baby Dream.
And a lot of people now know it because Bruce Springsteen plays it.
Yeah, Bruce Springsteen is one of the more unlikely Suicide fans I can think of.
Yeah. Oh, you keep that flame burning, babe. Yeah, you gotta keep that flame burning forever, baby. Dream baby dream. Yeah, come on, baby, keep that dream burning. Yeah. Forever. And ever. Forever. And that's the Suicide track, Dream Baby Dream. Okay, so now let's talk about Suicide as music and what it dovetailed with from around that time. Cluster was another band that used the same kind of rhythm machine, right?
They used a machine called the Elka Rhythm Box.
Yeah.
And they used an organ. That was their classic setup. So if you listen to an album like Zuckerzeit by Cluster,
which came
out in 1974.
Yeah.
You'll hear, obviously, they had a very different style. They were not confrontational whatsoever. But you'll hear, sonically, you'll hear some definite similarities between Cluster, which was a so-called krautrock band in Germany, mm-hmm. and Suicide. The thing with Suicide is that it's just so aggressive. Like, it's so in your face. It's like Suicide literally could have used anything. It didn't need to be an organ. Like, they could have taken a toy piano
and
a tin can, two sticks, and they would have made amazing music.
So this is a really interesting idea, that their concept was almost extra musical and so enormous and so kind of permissive that that they could have used any sound, any instrument, and it still would have been recognizably Suicide. Maybe this is part of the question that I'm getting at, which is that, you know, there's very few people I know who think of Alan Vega as their favorite artist or Suicide as their favorite band, you know? I mean, maybe outside of Henry Rollins, you know? People understand the importance of Suicide, etc., but it's never like, yeah, that's my band. That's my band. It's more like that they were a sort of concept or an example or a metaphor or something like that. They were so important, and yet you don't – we were just talking about The Fall. You don't see interviews with Marquis Smith where he says, yep, it was all about Suicide. You know, they were my John Coltrane. You don't see interviews with Big Black or, you know, like various bands later whose sound somehow traces back to Suicide. You don't see people like that saying, yep, it all came from there.
Yeah.
Was it because they were so one of a kind? Was it because they were so conceptual?
Yeah, I think almost in a way, you know, with some of these bands, their impact is like so much embedded in who you are. Like the Velvet Underground or Iggy or Suicide, where it's so indelibly a part of you or your music or your the way you look at life, that it becomes like part of the landscape. Like I felt this when David Bowie died, that David Bowie had impacted all these aspects of my life and had really meant so much to me, as he meant to so many people. But could I place exactly why or where I first even heard David Bowie or anything? I couldn't. He had become so incredibly part of the fabric of my life that it's the same with Alan Vega and with Suicide. It's like you almost forget where you first heard them because they become the new normal in a way. It's like nobody sounded like Suicide before Suicide. Then Suicide does what they do, and suddenly it becomes part of history. It becomes a sound. It becomes its own thing.
And yet, at the same time, it's new and revolutionary and whatever, but it's like it was already there. You know, like it makes sense. Okay, so we've got Alan Vega witnessing Iggy Pop in 1969. There's some sort of Velvet Underground Lou Reed thing in there. But do you have any sense that, you know, were they listening to German music? Were they listening to Eno?
I'm sure they were aware of him, especially as he was in New York a lot in the late 70s and even lived in New York. Eno lived in New York for a while.
Oh, right. Okay. So did their paths cross? Do you know about that?
He produced that No New York record.
Yeah.
And he was probably extremely interested in, I can't imagine why he wouldn't be interested in Suicide and their sound. But I don't know about that. I know that, that Alan Vega said in an interview that he had been banned from CBGBs for several years for some obscure reason. I don't think he said why.
Mm-hmm.
There was a time where Suicide couldn't play there. You know, that scene was pretty small, and I'm sure that everybody rubbed shoulders with everybody else. But in a way, they're very, very different artists. It was really like they invented their own sound, and it was a very particular and distinct sound. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's kind of one of the cool things about Suicide. It's just even in terms of the timbres, it's like I can listen to 0.5 seconds of a song and be like, "That's Suicide,"
sure,
because it's such a signature sound.
Yeah,
it's so classic now. Like this morning, I was looking like people bidding on eBay for like this cheesy rhythm box that Suicide used because they want to probably try to duplicate that sound that they made out of necessity but is now like a really cool vintage sound.
Sometimes what they were doing seemed to be almost like a photographic negative of a song, where the beats wouldn't be, hard cracks. Sometimes it would be like puff sounds.
Yeah.
Like something that might actually, in other music, exist around the beat.
Yeah.
And in Alan Vega's singing, there's so much kind of like gasping for air and, stuff that goes around words.
Yeah.
Very weird. Like unsongs.
Yeah.
Unsongs. And also in the way... the way he used words. I mean, you said he loved people who got straight to the point, but the way he used words was sort of never quite arriving at the point. I mean, he might have a tagline or a title phrase that he would come around to and hit on it, but very circuitous. And he'd sort of be in the song and standing off to the side of the song.
Yeah.
At the same time, you know?
In some ways, I feel like Suicide took the Velvet Underground to their logical conclusion. Maybe if the Velvet Underground hadn't been, like, as good as they were, in a way. Because, Lou Reed really became this guitar muso, or he really wanted to solo and, do all this stuff. John Cale obviously came from a really amazing musical background and had made so much amazing music on his own and with the Theater of Eternal Music and all of this other stuff, that they were actually much more like a muso band in a lot of ways. They had more chops, whereas with Suicide, it was really like there is nothing complicated or hard to play on, especially on that first Suicide album. Like anybody could play that stuff.
That's right.
It's even easier than like raw three-chord rock. They said punk was supposed to be so easy because anybody could pick up a guitar and play like you know, a 1-4-5 chord progression. But this is even easier than that. I mean, getting an organ and playing, in a lot of cases, not even chords. I mean, they're just literally like, you can almost imagine Martin Rev like sitting there on an organ, like playing it with one finger. Like it's right. like, right. it's like so simple. It's like childlike simple. And they said that punk was supposed to be simple, but believe me, like I've had a guitar and I've tried to play some of that music, and a lot of it's actually not as simple as you would think it would be. But Suicide, I could totally play. So they did get more complicated as they progressed as a band.
Well, I was going to bring this up, but why don't we hear a little bit of Suicide's second record, the track called Diamonds, Fur Coat, Champagne.
Diamonds.
That's Diamonds, Fur Coat, Champagne from Suicide's second record, which is really different.
It's extremely different.
So what were the changes they made and why?
The first album came out in 1977, and then the second album came out in 1980. And it came out on Z Records. It was much more produced. It was actually produced by Rick Ocasek of the Cars fame. It has actual synthesizers on it. Rick Ocasek loaned them a lot of equipment, including like a Prophet 5 synthesizer. It's obviously a lot more complicated sounding. And it's also much more danceable in a way. And it's not really a dance music album, but it's definitely leaning more in that direction. It's Suicide as a band that you could maybe play their songs on a dance floor. But I'm talking like a dance floor at Danceteria or the Mud Club, not like...
So somebody had the idea that Suicide could actually be a success.
Yes. So the head of Z Records, and this may be an apocryphal story, he played Giorgio Moroder and Donna Summer's classic I Feel Love for Rick Ocasek, and he said, I want Suicide to sound like I Feel Love. But there was no way that anything Suicide was going to make was going to sound anything like I Feel Love.
Right.
I mean, the other story is that the head of Z Records also wanted Giorgio Moroder to produce Suicide's second album, which I think is quite funny because you would imagine by 1980, the amount of money that Giorgio Moroder would probably command to produce somebody's album was significant. But, you know, it was a nice pipe dream. I think Rick Ocasek did an incredible job producing that album. He's a great producer. A lot of people I know in dance music actually... they name-checked the second album, not the first album.
But, really?
You know, Suicide's very, very famous for their first album.
Yeah.
Not really their second album. But a lot of people I know really love that second album.
Well, the thing about Suicide fandom that I find interesting, especially as the first record leads toward the second, is that I didn't see Suicide in the 70s or the 80s. I only saw them in various, like, reunited states. Much more recently. But a friend of mine here at the Times, Jeff Roth, saw them in the 70s. And, you know, his remark about it was like, there was absolutely no middle ground. If you were there for whatever reason, you would say, yeah, this is good, you know? Or you would say, this is terrible. There was no like, yeah, this is okay. people just would not have that reaction at all. And the first record leads you toward that conclusion, you know? The first record makes that understandable. The second record, I don't know. What do you think? I can imagine people saying, yeah, this is pretty good.
Yeah, it did, definitely didn't have,
there.
Didn't have the seismic impact
yeah.
that the first album had. But I would also say, you know, this either you love it or you hate it thing, when I hear that, that's like music to my ears because when I think of like all of the music that I really, really love is like extremely polarizing. I always think it's good when I see a bunch of really good reviews and a bunch of really bad reviews of an album, because then I'm like, oh, I really want to hear this. Because the worst for me is hearing an album where I'm just indifferent or kind of meh or have no opinion. That's like that just makes me sad. But music that, you know, it's like the old saying that, you know, you can't make an omelet without breaking a few eggs. Mm-hmm. I mean, Suicide broke all the eggs. You know, it's like they just I can imagine lots of people running out of a Suicide show in the 70s with like their hands over their ears going like, make it stop.
Sure.
Let's also remember, you know, that Suicide played a bunch of shows with The Clash. I think this was in 78. Very different fan bases, I would say. Clash fans and Suicide fans. I think it was Elvis Costello and The Clash and Suicide, if I recall correctly. And that would have had to be really weird to see those three acts together on the same bill. And I can imagine a lot of people like leaving when Suicide was playing and coming back to see The Clash or whatever.
Well, actually, I'm sure you know there's a recording of Suicide in one of those opening slots for Elvis Costello. It's called 28 Minutes Over Brussels or something like that. It's a one long track that's on that came out on the CD version of the first Suicide album. And toward the end of that 28-minute stretch or whatever it is, somebody steals the microphone from Alan Vega and effectively, you know, sort of shuts the band down. And so there's sort of a confrontation at the end. But leading up toward that moment, they're playing their set. And after each song, there's really committed cheering and then a big sea of boos. Like you hear lots of boos, but you hear really purposeful cheering.
You know, it was like the old story with the Velvet Underground where not a lot of people listened to their music, but everybody who did started a band.
Yeah.
I think it was that way with Suicide as well, that a lot of these people went on to create bands, whether they were in, I would say more like synth pop, early synth pop, these early goth bands. I see a very direct line between, let's say, songs like Frankie Teardrop and like Bela Lugosi's Dead by Bauhaus. You know, that to me, there's like a very direct line between those two songs. A lot of admirers, Susie and the Banshees, were fans of Suicide, Soft Cell, you know, all of those guys. I mean, you got to think like probably Depeche Mode in the early days.
Mm-hmm.
We're aware of Suicide, the more dancey sort of goth industrial music that came to be known as electronic body music, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
That a lot of that stuff, you can really hear some kind of ancestral roots in what Suicide was doing.
Well, so at the beginning of this conversation, you were saying that now you hear a lot of music where the artists or the producers are indebted to Suicide. What are some of those records? Who are some of those?
Well, I think of it more as, like I said, it's very subtle. One of the reasons why Suicide's music is so long-lasting and we still listen to it now, I think is because the sound is so minimal. It doesn't sound dated. It sounds like, you know, that you could have put it out this year. It really doesn't sound like the 70s. Even like the other records that came out in 1977, and a lot of amazing albums came out in 1977, but, you know, because it's so stripped down, a lot of the dance music albums that people still think of as cool now, kids in Brooklyn will still dance to like a Chicago House song from 1986 or a Detroit techno song from 1992. Mm-hmm. A lot of that music still doesn't sound dated. You know, Alan Vega said something like, you know, we were so ahead of our time. He's not the most modest guy, like in interviews. Like, Alan Vega is like totally full of hubris and is completely, but it was like the rest, everybody else like caught up to us basically. That, you know, sometimes you have to do that. You have to do something that totally shocks the system and then everybody else catches up.
I mean, they were maybe ahead of their time, but also just weirdly out of time. As you said, they were using outdated equipment. They were calling on energies that did predate them, including Elvis Presley or beat poetry or whatever. The thing that they were doing wasn't necessarily of its time. I mean, aggression, aggression is from any time. So then the sound of suicide is echoed much later on. But what are you really hearing? Are you hearing suicide in 1977, or are you hearing all the currents and patterns and energies that created suicide?
They were coming out of this really dated sounding, very, like you said, like kind of Elvis, all of that stuff. But then, you know, taking from that stuff, but then making this really kind of weird new sound with it. So it's funny because you hear that in Alan Vega's sort of throaty voice.
Yeah.
This kind of, Roy Orbison, Elvis Presley kind of warble to his voice that feels very not of the 1970s. And you also hear how good they were as songwriters. So, like, another part of the reason why I think Suicide has lasted is because those are good songs. So, like, Cherie is a good song. Dream Baby Dream is a good song. And they're songs that everybody remembers. They're songs that you don't need a bunch of stuff to dress it up, you know? You don't need
right.
a bunch of backing vocals and a bass player and a drum kit and all of these other things. And basically, it sounds like a bunch of demos. You know, the first Suicide album is really, it sounds like these weird demos
yeah.
by this band singing weird, like Elvis Presley-inspired songs with like really janky late 60s cheap thrift store equipment,
yeah.
like fed through a bunch of effects pedals. And yet it somehow totally works.
Yes.
Like if I had
right.
to write that down on paper, you'd be like, oh, that sounds awful.
Sure, sure, sure. That's
but,
the thing.
But it somehow all hangs together.
It's the demo like and it's the finished project.
Exactly.
And by the same token, proto-punk and post-punk.
Yeah.
At the same time.
Exactly.
So Geeta Dayal, thank you so much for coming.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, get on that bullhorn. There's no little Christmas shoes, baby. For your lady this year. Yeah, no little gangs and toys. For your kids this year. Yeah. Yeah, just the door slams. Door slams.
You're hearing Fat City, a track from a later recording by Alan Vega. Alan Vega with Alex Chilton and Ben Vaughn, an album recently re-released called Cubist Blues. That's our show. Thanks a lot for listening. Thanks to Geeta Dayal for coming. You can read John Pareles' recent obituary of Alan Vega at nytimes.com/music. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can hear this episode and all other previous episodes of the podcast at nytimes.com/podcast. See you next week.